Okay, so we've been working on Hashgacha for a number of Shiurim, and really we could spend the rest of the Zman on it. Really, my hope was to work on Ramban Shita, which is particularly complex, and talk also about his Mahalich in terms of the problem of evil, which he deals with as well in this context. And if we have a chance today, we'll try to see that. But I think it's time to move on to another sugya after today. So what we're going to start with is the Mahalich of the Baal Shem Tov on Hashgacha, as requested by some of the Chevra. And if we have time, we'll refer to others at the end. So you have the Marmakomos. And one of the interesting things about the topic is that, as a number of you have noted, when you look at the Rishonim on Hashgacha, many of them, not just the Ramban in places, and many other Rishonim, the Ran and Drashos, seem to advocate a somewhat limited approach to Hashgacha. Each one has their own signon, and there are important differences among the Rishonim, but I would say that it seems to me that the majority opinion in Rishonim is not that everything is Hashgacha. There are some Rishonim who have such a Mahalich, like Rabbeinu Bach and Chol HaSvavo, seemingly, but there are issues there as well. At the same time, certainly the contemporary view is that everything is Hashgacha. Not just, you know, when you read the Hashgacha Pratis books, but many of the Svarim, we've already mentioned earlier, the Chazon Ish, Rav Dessler especially, many of the contemporary Svarim, really for hundreds of years already, Ramchal, seemingly take a much more robust view on Hashgacha. And one of the things we're going to talk about is how could that be? How could there be such a change? Certainly a big part of the change relates to the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov lived from 1698 to 1760. His actual name was Rabbi Yisrael Bar Lazar, Rabbi Eliezer, and he's known as the founder of Chassidus. And his view on Hashgacha is quite radical. And as we'll see, though, in another sense, has become quite normative. Now, what we're doing in a certain sense today, when we compare, let's say, the Baal Shem Tov to the Rambam, or even the Ramban, is not pashut methodologically. Why? Because unlike the Rambam, who presents a systematized approach to Hashgacha. Now, we saw last week, not entirely clear what he held. It's hard, but okay, he has 20 chapters on Hashgacha. He brings rayas, he brings kashas, there's a shakla mitarya. He addresses the question as a sugya. When it comes to the Baal Shem Tov certainly did not write a book or any type of systematized philosophy. In terms of his own writings, we just have a couple of letters. Most of what we have are the writings that his students recorded. And oftentimes these are short vartlach, stories, drashos, but it's certainly not the same type of approach that you see in, let's say, the Rishonim on this topic. So at the same, you know, we're to some degree, if we try to compare them, you know, it's like comparing math and art. They're very different mahalchim. You know, much of, as we'll see, what we know from the Baal Shem Tov comes from a story that the Talmidim record as to like what he said when he was going for a walk. So that's very different. But at the same time, in the end of the day, these teachings, these stories have come down to us, and they do present a distinct approach to Hashgacha. And it's one, like we said before, that has had a huge effect on the broader Jewish view on Hashgacha. And therefore, it's very important to try our best to try to understand that, even as we realize that the types of presentations are very, very different. So the Baal Shem Tov held, as we mentioned before, that Hashgacha is all-encompassing. It encompasses everything. Even when a branch falls from a tree, how it falls is Hashgacha. And the Baal Shem Tov quotes a pasuk to support this view. The pasuk is from Koheles, Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Gimel. It says, "Mekom sheyipol ha'etz sham yehu." Wherever the tree falls, that's where it should be. And he understood this means that if it fell in a particular way, that's the way it was supposed to fall. That's the way it was supposed to be. There's hashkacha, even how a tree falls down. So if you remember, we saw the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Zayin Mabeis, that says even the seemingly insignificant things that happen to a person are hashkacha. Ein adam nokef etzba'o milamata, elim ke mafrizin alav milamala. The Baal Shem Tov says, it's not just about the bruised toe, but even the way a tree falls down. And if you take a look at the first source we're going to see, this is from Rav Mendel of Vitebsk. He was a Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov. He lived from 1730 to 1788. And he tells us that the Baal Shem Tov understood from this pasuk that even the placement of a blade of grass is the result of a hachraza milamala. So let's take a look over here. This is again the Pri Haaretz, Mendel Vitebsk. It's interesting, you know. It's a Hasidic sefer. He was actually, I think, a third generation of Hasidic leaders. He was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezrich, and he was very important in the spreading of Hasidus. It's not a sefer that is learned so much by Litvak, though. I saw yesterday, we were looking into something else. Interestingly, I saw that the Rav Dessler quotes this. So it's an important sefer that that we should also learn. So he writes like this: V'hinei be'emes rachok me'rishaim. Vayifag libam lahamin hashkacha pratis kazu she'en adam nokef etzba'o ve'en shum esev nekar ve'en shum even nizrak ki'im bizman uvimakom avroilo k'maymar makom shipol ha'etz sham yihu. So it's difficult for a shayim to believe that there could be such hashkacha, that even on the smallest things. Again, he's quoting the Gemara, but he's taking it one step further. He's saying the Gemara is not just about the things that happen to a person, but even the placement of a blade of grass. Now, if you think about it for a moment, it makes a lot of sense, actually. Like, why shouldn't it be that way? Kadosh Baruch Hu is all-knowing. He's all-powerful. Why shouldn't even the smallest, seemingly most insignificant detail be intentional? We're not careful about small details because we're limited in our seichel. We can't think about 10 trillion details at a time. But obviously, that's not Shach to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So why not? Another place where we see this is a piece from with Pinchas of Koritz. He lived from 1728 to 1790, also a Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov. And look at how he puts it, because he writes over here that it's not just that this is true, but it's an ikar of emuna. Ha'adam tsarich lahamin shafilu kash hamunach al haaretz hu b'gzeiras Hashem yisparach shagazar liyos munach sham. So even how a straw is placed on the ground, that is a gzeirah from Hashem. Vani. And I, meaning the person who's writing this is now a Talmud of Pinchas, Shamati kemeduma b'ze halashon sheyesh hashkacha pratis ech tehei munachas emaktzavos l'kan l'kan. Right, I heard from Pinchas of Koritz that, you know, that the blade of straw is like northeast, southwest, even that is subject to hashgacha. So there are, now, there were thinkers, as we mentioned before, before the Baal Shem Tov, who adopted a more all-encompassing approach to hashgacha, but nobody that I'm aware of before the Baal Shem Tov said that, you know, ad kadei kach, that it applies to everything, even to animals. We'll see, some Rishonim did hold it was for animals, but even to inanimate objects, even to this, even to, you know, like we said, a blade of grass. In fact, we saw that the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim 3:17, the Sefer Chinuch, Mitzvah Kuf Samach Tes, writes that there were non-Jewish thinkers who held this way, and the Rishonim held, said that the Torah rejects this view. There's a very, very interesting letter, very important letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Nachum Mendel Schneerson, who summarizes the view of the Besht and also how it differed from those who came before him. And he deals with all these issues. I put the letter in the source sheets. And he writes, first of all, in terms of what the Besht held, Hashgacha pratis b'chol prat uprat mima'oros ha'adam v'gam hadatzach. So even in inanimate objects. And what we want to think about now is, why did, let's say, the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Sefer HaChinuch reject this approach? And why did the Baal Shem Tov adopt it? What's the Nekudas HaMachlokas? So, again, let's turn to what the Lubavitcher Rebbe writes. Chalukim ba'ofen hashgacha, avalo b'pratiyoseha l'shitas habesht. Mashen ken l'shitos shekadmuhu. V'lo od. Ela shekulam madregos nalos b'hashgacha kolpanim neis milubash. So here he's giving a very interesting point. We find many psukim. We saw some of them quoted by the Rambam last week. And midrashim in Chazal, even in the Zohar, that talk about how there's special hashgacha for tzaddikim. So how is that true? If everybody is subject to absolute hashgacha all the time, what's the mila of tzaddikim? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe is answering that how is this different from the approaches that preceded? Really, the question is, everyone could say, the psukim aren't saying that only tzaddikim have hashgacha. What the psukim are telling us is that there's a higher level of hashgacha for tzaddikim in the sense that it's a nes that's more obvious. Madregos na'alos b'hashgacha kopanim nes melubash. Meaning to say that when it says that there's special hashgacha and shmira and the like for tzaddikim, it means that it's more overt, it's more noticed, it's more obvious. Whereas there's nothing obvious about the hashgacha that happens to a blade of grass, right? Nobody looked at the blade of grass and said, oh, wow, look at the hashgacha pratis, that the grass landed this way and not that way. It might be hashgacha pratis, but it's not noticeable. And so what the psukim, when they highlight what's special about the chassidim, is they're saying that these chassidim were zocha, the divine intervention in their life was much more manifest. It was much more apparent. Whereas for the lower forms, it's less obvious. But fundamentally, there's no difference. Fundamentally, there's no difference in terms of the hashgacha, whether you're a tzaddik and a chassid, or you're a beinoni, or you're a piece of grass. Good. So we have no kashas from the psukim. But still, what's behind the, as I said, this approach of the Baal Shem Tov. And I want to ask a different question, which is, does it relate to his broader theology? In other words, is this just happened to be the Baal Shem Tov's view, or does it relate to the Mahalich of Chassidus in general? So the answer is, very much it does. And in light of this, we could understand why the Baal Shem Tov says what he says, and we could also appreciate how it relates to Chassidus. The Zohar states, you have it over here, Les Asar Panui Minei. What does that mean? There's no place devoid of him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere. And this is a very important approach to Chassidus. If you just open up your eyes and you look, you can see it. Take a look. This is from the Maggid of Meserich, who, as you all know, is one of the primary disseminators of the Torah of the Baal Shem Tov. And this is what he writes. V'leis asar panui minei, v'akol malei mechius haborei baruchu. Nimtza kol ma sherohehu roe rak chius haborei hanimshach bo. So there's no place empty of him. Everywhere you look, everything you see, you're seeing the life kilu of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's drawn through it. And this idea is, maybe if we have a chance later on today, we'll try to explain a little more, but it's certainly one of the central principles of Chassidus. We talked about it a little bit earlier in the year when we did Tamei Mitzvos, and we talked about the approach in Chassidus to Tamei HaMitzvos, in general, to our avoda in this world. And that's certainly relevant. And maybe, again, if we have a chance today, we'll talk more about it. But the point that's relevant now for us is that if we encounter HaKadosh Baruch Hu wherever we look, so there's no reason to imagine that anything we see, even the seemingly most unimportant things, a blade of grass, is random. Because like everything in creation, it's an act of God. Now, it's not just the Baal Shem Tov or Hasidic thoughts, thinkers, like I mentioned before, but this is a very common mahalich among Baalei Machshava. And just to appreciate that, we'll take a look now at a piece from Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler, along similar lines, makes the argument that Teva does not exist. There is no such thing as nature. It's a mirage. It's an illusion. Again, if you remember in the earlier shiur, we talked about the approach of the Baal Shem Tov, that Tzimtzum is also an illusion. Even though it might seem like HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzamtzem himself in order to allow for the existence of the world, he wasn't actual mitzamtzem himself, like we said, leis asar panui minei. And it's interesting, Ha'ara, because we said that was part of what's behind the Mahalich of the Baal Shem Tov's approach to Hashgacha. Rav Dessler also was a strong advocate that everyone agrees that Tzimtzum is an illusion, or what's sometimes called Tzimtzum delo kipshuto. And there's some debate about this. I don't want to go into that now. Maybe another time we could talk about it. There's some debate. There are some lashonos of certain mekubalim that sound like they think Tzimtzum is literal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu literally removed his presence. There are some who say that's the view of the Gaon. Though to me, you know, there's not really strong evidence that the Vilna Gaon held this way. And certainly the Baal Shem, the Nefesh HaChaim didn't learn the Gaon that way. Anyway, it's not our sugya now. But Rav Dessler certainly is a very strong advocate of the perspective that everyone, including the Vilna Gaon, held that there's no such thing as real Tzimtzum. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere. He didn't, it only gave the appearance of limiting himself and creating a vacuum, but in reality, he didn't. And that too, just like we said, that relates to the Baal Shem Tov's approach to Hashgacha, probably relates to Rav Dessler's approach as well. So Rav Dessler tells us that nature, teva, is simply what we commonly see, what happens frequently. Rav Dessler writes that this is what the Ramban means when he says that anyone who says that there's such a thing as teva has no chelek in Torah's Moshe, because everything is a nes. Some things are nes nister, some things are nes nigla. That's the famous Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo. We don't have time to go into it, but there are other passages in Ramban, like his comments in Bereishis Yud Ches and elsewhere, where he does seem to believe that there's such a thing as Tava. Again, if we have time, we could talk about how to Mahalich to be Miyashiv those places. But the way Rav Dessler learns Ramban is that this is exactly what Ramban is saying. So what does that mean? When we see that apples fall from a tree, right? They fall down. They don't fall up. So we categorize that as gravity, as a law of nature. But in reality, it's nothing more than a description of past events. There's no such thing as teva. It happens to be that the last 32 million times apples fell off a tree, they went down and they didn't go up. That's it. There's no law of gravity. That's just what's common. There's no fundamental difference between apples floating up and apples floating down. Because why do they fall down? Because Hashem wants them to fall down and he could just as easily float up. So teva is the means by which HaKadosh Baruch Hu hides his providence by frequently acting in a predictable way. But it doesn't exist. It's something that allows us to err. It's something that gives us bechira, but it doesn't actually exist. You have this piece over here for the Mechtam Eliyahu who says this. I also put a piece from the Gra that sounds like he's saying this. The Gra Nya Ha'or.
How do all these thinkers deal with the Rambam's explicit critique of that position?
Well, we'll have to see. We'll get there. Be'ezus Hashem.
Is there a difference really between, I mean, everybody's going to agree that God has the ability to change it and that it only exists because God is constantly making it happen. So that's
a question. In other words, is there a difference between saying Hashem created the laws of nature and he could change them if he wishes versus saying that there is no such thing as nature and HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly decides each and every time which way the apple should fall. From the Rishonim, at the very least, you get the impression that there is a difference between them. In other words, there's such a thing as a nes. A nes isn't just something that differs than what usually happens. There's teva, and the nes goes against teva. What you're suggesting, is, and this is the approach of Rav Dessler in a certain sense, that there is no difference. And therefore, there's no reason to believe that there's such a thing as teva. There's nothing wrong with studying science. Science is very useful because by going ahead and discovering the patterns that have happened in the past, it's going to be helpful going forward. Rav Dessler would agree that it's not smart to stand underneath, like the Gemara says, shaky ladder, a broken ladder. He doesn't say, why should it be usher? Maybe it's going to float up this time and not fall down. So there's no question that the patterns that have existed in the past are significant, and they're halachically significant. Like we said, you can't do things that are dangerous, and danger is determined by these patterns. So it's a conceptual difference, but it's an important difference. How is HaKadosh Baruch Hu manhig the world? Is he manhig the world through creating laws of nature and then occasionally breaking them? Or is he manhig directly? That seems to be a debate. So again, you have over here a couple of passages from the Gra, the Chazon Ish, Rav Dessler, who all seem to advocate this approach. We saw, for example, that it's not so pashut in the Gra. We saw it's not so pashut in the Chazon Ish. Remember, we saw the Chazon Ish at the end of the previous semester, who, despite what he says over here, where he says she'ein mikra ba'olam, there's no such thing as mikra. Likewise, in the Igeres, Masha Anukorim Teva, Hamachulin Bezet, Ratzon Hayoser Masmid, just what's common. Yet at the same time, we saw the Chazon Ish in Bava Basra, who doesn't sound that way, and we had a Mahalich to try to answer it. But that the primary view, I would say, of the Chazon Ish certainly is what we see over here. So now we have to ask, and again, this gets back to our question of what are the Rishonim arguing about, which is, what is the purpose of this all-encompassing providence? To put it differently, we could just say, why not? In other words, the reason why, if I was creating a world, I would set up something like Teva and then occasionally intervene to change things as needed, is because I'm limited. Like I said, you know, I need to go to sleep. I can't pay attention to every single detail at every single moment. But for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's not true. So why would he make such a thing as Teva? Teva is just something that you do because, you know, we would do because of our weakness. But why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu make Teva? So that might be part of it. Take a look again back at this letter we have in Lubavitcher Rebbe. He has two answers to this question. Here he's quoting from an essay that he wrote called Al Kein Yomru, which was published in 1936 or written in 1936. And let's just take a look over here. Inyan Hashkacha Pratis, She Mivayar Morenu Habesht, De Lo Zu Levad, De Kol Pratei Tnuas HaNevraim Liminehem, Heim Bashkacha Pratis Nebaris Baruch. Bashkacha Pratis Al Zu, Hi Chiyos HaNivra V'Kiyumo, Ela, De Od Zos, De Tnua Pratis De Nivra, Prati, Hare yesh la yachas klali leklalus kavanas habriya. Tenua achas, skipping a little, shel deshe prati, mashlim ha-kavana ha-elyona binyan habriya. Says a very fascinating idea here. He says the pshat is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan in the world. We don't always know the plan. We don't see the plan, but it's true. There's a purpose in a creation. Everything happens for a reason. And therefore, you know, Lamashal, the Rambam wrote that when it comes to animals, there's hashkacha lagabe, this, the min, the species, but not the particular animal. And why did the Rambam say that? Why did the Rambam distinguish between animals and people? Same thing in the Ramban. Is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world for people. People have Bechira, people could be Ovdei Hashem. So it makes sense that there'd be Hashkacha for people, or at least the possibility for Hashkacha. When it comes to animals, so animals are here for us, but not for their own sake, and therefore not that way. Now, this interesting Shiloh, which we're not going to get into now, which is, does the Rambam think everything was created for people or not? Originally he said it was. Then he said, maybe that's something we can't know. But leave that issue aside. That's the pashtus. So Baal Shem Tov says, wait one second. Even if that's right, that the animals are here for people, but everything plays a role for people. So whether or not you know, the ant goes here or not there. That too is relevant for people. The smallest details of the design are relevant for people. Everything has a role. Everything has a purpose. And we don't see, we can't perceive how, you know, the leaf being this way or that way or the like is relevant for us. But everything is part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. So if everything is bediktuk, then there has to be ashgacha for everything. Nothing could be random. That's reason one, and we're going to get back to that in a moment. Reason number two, he says, is la'mekubalim hanal, kevan de be'inyan ha'gilgul, yeshem is galgul in bedatzach. Sometimes people are gilgul neshamos, transmigration of the soul, whatever that means exactly, but sometimes, according to mekubalim, there's a gilgul even in domeim, Tzomeach and Bali Chaim. L'chora barur shebedatzach ka'elu yesh b'mashkacha. So if you think that the grasshopper is a Gilgal, it might be a Gilgal, so then for sure there has to be hashkacha. This is sort of interesting because remember the Rambam said that there's only hashkacha for people because people are, you know, are that elevated thing. But if you think a grasshopper could also be a person, I mean, have the neshama of a person, so then memela makes sense that there would be hashkacha for grasshoppers. In other words, according to this approach, if you think that, suppose the first approach is saying, look, everything is for people, but part of the divine plan, every small thing, could make a difference. The second thing is that no, be'etzem the hashkacha on the grasshopper or even on the grass is because it could be a gilgul of a person. Very interesting idea. Now, let's talk about for a moment about the chiddush here. So, how do we deal with and Zach? Zachary, you brought up this question. How do we understand that the Baal Shem Tov is being machadesh here, something that goes against many Rishonim, certainly not mentioned by the Rishonim? Many Rishonim even say this concept is a non-Jewish concept. So how do we deal with that? What's interesting is in this letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, He cites many passages from the Emor Nevuchim and other Rishonim and notes how they differ from the Baal Shem Tov. And he even notes that the Sefer HaChinuch, like I said, writes that there's no Jewish thinker that ever maintained this view of the Baal Shem Tov. And not only that, but he cites the Shomer Amunim, who says that even the earlier Mekubalim did not take this approach. So the Chiddush, it's not just that the, you know, rationalists didn't hold this way, but even the Mekubalim didn't hold this way. He argues that you could see the ideas of the Baal Shem Tov in Psukim, in Chazal, as we saw before, but what's the pshat that the Rishonim totally missed it? You know, how could we... how could we say that? You know, don't we usually hold that, you know, in Rishonim kamalachim anuk ne'adam, as it were, right? We study the Torah Rishonim. We don't just dismiss their view. Now, it's true that in matters of machshava, it's different than matters of halacha. The authority of Rishonim is not as concrete in matters of hashkacha. It's also true, you know, it's possible that part of the hesitancy in some Rishonim, at least, to this type of all-encompassing hashkacha stemmed from their sort of Greek-influenced perspective on the universe, and with the waning influence of Greek science and philosophy. So there's some of the motivations in the Rishonim are no longer there. It's possible, but still, you know, it's a very shocking thing. I think we find two approaches to dealing with this question. The first approach is to say that even though this idea doesn't sound this way in Rishonim, the Rishonim do actually hold of it. You just have to read them carefully. As we saw before, Ramban argues this is the view of Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler argues this is the view of the Ramban, that there's no such thing as Teva. Others even argue this is the view of the Rambam. A number of Achronim make that point. I saw Ephraim Pinzauer has a beautiful sefer on Hashgacha Pratis, and in the back of the most recent edition, he has an essay by one of the Ingerman in the River Der Kollel, who argues that the Rambam holds of an expansive shita in Hashgacha, and there are a number of great Balei Machshava who take that approach. So that's one approach, to say that, yeah, even a Rishonim hold of this type of all-encompassing Hashgacha. However, the Lubavitcher Rebbe takes a different approach. And he says that, no, there was a shift. Taka, there's a big shift between, let's say the Rishonim and the Baal Shem Tov. So how does he explain that? So I want to look at a different piece from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I put this one in English. It's from a different source. But he says something interesting. He's addressing a slightly different question, but I think the words that he says over there are relevant here as well. And he's talking about the innovation of Chassidus. And, why is there an innovation of Chassidus? Why did it come when it came? How could it be? And he says that there's two explanations. Number one is because there's so much darkness in our world. As time went on, in a sense, we got further and further from Matan Torah, and there was more and more darkness. And therefore, in the era as Mashiach's getting closer, so it's necessary to tap into a higher light to enable us to overcome that darkness. In other words, the Rishonim may not have been aware of this truth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't megala to them because it wasn't needed. That gilui wasn't necessary in their time. But as we go further on in history, the world is darker. So there's more of a need for that or that gilui. And that's the first reason. The second reason, that's sort of a pessimistic reason. The second reason, he says, is more of an optimistic reason. He quotes from the Arizal, which is cited by the Magen Avraham, that Tamei Chaim Zachu, just like L'mashal, some people have the minhag to taste a little bit of Shabbos food on Erev Shabbos, so too, as we get closer to Mashiach, in the generations before the coming of Mashiach, we're going to have a taste of the Shabbos food. So, Lasad Lavo, the panemius of the Torah is going to be revealed in a way that that it's not revealed now. And an aspect of that is going to be revealed in the generations, Mamish. If we think of the world as 6,000 years, so where are we holding now? We're mamish already by Plaga Mincha, if not later. And that being the case, there's a special giloy that's appropriate now. So as I said, this is sort of interesting, right? The first explanation is, as he points out, are sort of two extremes. One is positive, one is negative. I think that it's important to remember that even though we certainly believe that, as I said before, Rishonim k'malachim anu k'mei Adam, and if we are like, if Rishonim k'mei Adam anu k'chamorim, but at the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's a development of Torah. And the development of Torah is true in all sorts of ways. It's not just in Kabbalah, though certainly there is. For whatever reason, the Torah of Kabbalah was revealed and at a certain point. And with time, it got expanded. The Arizal changed Kabbalah. The Torah, the Kabbalah of the Arizal is very different than the Kabbalah of the Mekubalim beforehand, sort of up to and including the Ramak. And even subsequently, there's Giluyim. The Ramchal, for example, talks about Giluyim that he had in Kabbalah and the like. There's development, not just in terms of Giluyim, whether it's the development of the Bali Atosvos, or the Chachmei Sfarad, or the Briskers, or whatever it is. There's Hiskatnas Hadoros, but there's not necessarily a stira between Hiskatnas Hadoros and the development and even advancement of Torah. One mashal given by the Rid famously is, we're like midgets standing on the shoulders of giants, but in the end of the day, we could see further than the giants because we're taller. We could see further. We're building off of their accomplishments and taking it one step further. So the idea that there could be chiddush is not fundamentally problematic. And when these things are revealed is when it's appropriate for them to be revealed. Rav Kook writes a lot about this, about how when, HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens up certain perspectives and branches of wisdom and thoughts and ideas when they should happen. And that's how we could understand the development of Torah in the Tekufa, the Rishonim, by the rationalist Rishonim, by the Mekubalim and the like, and likewise in terms of our understanding of Hashkacha. That's number one. I should point out an interesting Ha'ara, which is these two reasons that we saw in the letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's not just the Lubavitcher Rebbe who said this. I saw very interestingly in the Hakdama of Rabbi Eliyahu Weintraub. Rabbi Weintraub was really one of the, in the previous generation. He lived, he died in 2010, one of the Litvisha Mekubalim, who is understood, accepted by the Litvisha Welt. And he cites the Leshem. He lived, he died in 1926. He was, of course, grandfather of Rav Eliashiv that we're aware of, two of the great, he was one of the great Litvisha Mekubalim as well. And he cites the Leshem, cites Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who said that from the year 5600, so that corresponds to 1840, and we'll see this based off of the Zohar, the gates of wisdom were opened and became available to the public. And he says, what's the reason? Why was it necessary for these certain ideas to become well known dafka now? It was necessary, A, to counteract the dominance of the kfira that became prevalent at that time, and two, is to prepare the world for the coming of the Mashiach. And really that's what it says in the Zohar. So essentially, the Leshem is saying the same two reasons that the Lubavitcher Rebbe said. Number one is to counteract the kfira that's relevant nowadays. It's very interesting to think about how Kabbalah counteracts kfira, but it does. And number two is that it prepares for Mashiach. So as I said, the Leshem, Rishol Salanter, they say it in a little different signon than Lubavitcher Rebbe, but the same two answers that he says, they say as well. The Lashon of the Zohar is, uvishis mea shanin Lishtisa'a, in other words, in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, so that would be the year 5600, 1840, Yispatchun Tar'e D'Chachmasa Le'ela. So the upper gates of wisdom are going to open up. Umivui D'Chachmasa Le'tasa. And the springs of Chachma from below. The Yisasku Be'alma. Okay, we can read on, but that's, it goes on. So that being the case, and the Zohar says this is to prepare the world for the seventh millennium, just like you prepare yourself on Erev Shabbos for Shabbos, and as the sun begins to go down, so likewise over here. And he has a remez for this in the pasuk by Noach, Bishna Sheish Meos Shana L'chai Noach, Nikba'u Kol Mayanos Tahom Rabbah, and the same thing over here, so the sixth century of the sixth millennium. That's what. Now, it's a little different maybe than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. They're saying that it's not so much a development as much as the opening of the gates of wisdom, it becoming more public. But still, I think a very similar idea. And that's the idea that, many things that were once known by only a few people are known by everybody nowadays. We earlier referred to the idea of Gilgulim. It's very interesting. The Ramban in Tarsa Adam and his Perish on Eov and several times in the Perish Ala Torah talks about this concept of Gilgul Neshamos. And it actually relates a lot to the Sugya of Hashgacha in the Book of Eov. He thinks that's the ultimate secret that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Megala to Eov at the end. But the Ramban writes that he doesn't actually say the words Gilgul anywhere. He calls it the Sod HaIbor. And he says, those who have a Mesorah for it know what I'm talking about. And if not, so you don't know what I'm talking about. He uses that to explain many things, the concept of Yibum, for example, and the whole story of Yehuda's sons relates to it. Ayin Sham. But the point is that the Ramban held that he can't even say it. In other words, if you read Ramban, you have no idea what he's talking about. So how do I know he's talking about Gilgulim? Because I used the Ramban with the footnotes on about him from Rav Shevel. And he points to the Rikanati, Rabbeinu Bachya, who say that's what the Ramban means. So, okay. So Ramban couldn't say it at all. Several generations later, some of the later Rishonim allude to it. But still, it was still something that, your average yeshiva buffer doesn't know about. You learn Mishnah Berurah nowadays. Mishnah Berurah talks about Gilgulim. So what was once, the domain of very few people, and about which we said it's usher to be Megalasoid, so now everybody knows about it. It's not to say that everybody knows everything. There's still aspects of Torah Sasod that are not as well known. And, one of the debates between, let's say, Hasidim versus Litvish is, to what degree is it appropriate to study Kabbalah when one is not yet of age and not yet of sufficient wisdom, hasn't been memale kriso lechem basar, what is the meaning of the Mishnah Chagiga and the like. But one way or the other, there's no question that there's been a tremendous hispatchos in this realm. And I think that we could look at the shift in terms of the nature of Hashgacha Pratis in this realm. Okay, so now I want to talk about Hashgacha on animals. And then we're going to get back to the Baal Shem Tov, you'll see, at the end. And why is that? Because the Rambam, as well as the Ramban, as we saw, held that there is no Hashgacha Pratis on animals. The Rambam says, I agree with Aristotle when it comes to animals. And I used to think that, that was the view of all Rishonim, that the concept of Hashgacha on animals was also part of the Chiddush of the Baal Shem Tov. And it was, to some degree. But really, actually, we have a lot in the Rishonim and in Chazal as well on Hashgacha on animals. So maybe we'll talk about it for a couple of minutes, and then we'll go back to the Besht and wrap it up. So where do we find this? So let's start with the Radak over here. This is Radak from Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Chaf Ches. And if you remember, this story over here is about a Navi who was sent from Yehuda to admonish the king of Yisrael, and he violated Hashem's command upon his return. And so Hashem sent a lion that killed him. But the lion didn't eat his corpse, and nor did the donkey, didn't even touch the donkey that the Navi was riding on. And Radak says, why is it? You know, I understand why a nace was necessary, that the lion didn't eat the corpse of the Navi. Okay, the Navi was a Navi. He might have done the wrong thing, but he was still a Navi. But why didn't, you know, why was this nace necessary that the lion didn't eat the donkey upon which the Navi was riding? So let's take a look at the Radak over here. He writes, V'chein gam gmul hachamor ba'olam hazeh l'chvod ha-navi sh'rachav alav ki yesh gmul v'onesh b'shar ba'lechayim ba'olam hazeh b'inyin ha'adam. So the donkey was rewarded in this world. That's why it wasn't hurt by the lion, because there's reward and punishment for animals in this world on account of man, binyan ha'adam. So on the one hand, the Radak is saying that there is gmul, but on the other hand, he's saying this was done entirely for man. This is very similar to the halacha that we know, that an animal is killed when it kills a person. And in that sense, we could say that it's entirely on its account of man. However, elsewhere, the Radak explains that this pasuk in Malachim might support the position that animals, at least to some degree, are not just rewarded on account of man, but they're rewarded for their behavior or punished for their behavior when they interact with humans. So he's going on the psukim that we say every day. L'chol chai sounds like even animals. And many psukim in Tanakh talk about how Hashem gives food to animals, and Radak adds that it's betzedek uviyosher nosim l'chol echad ochlo. That's what the pasuk is teaching us. Now, we know, though, that animals attack each other. Chves, a cat eats a mouse. Mouse, is that just? Did the mouse do anything wrong that the cat should eat it? So the Radak over here says, very interesting. He says, that's just because hakol tzadak mi'ito, ki gam l'chayos v'ofos hanitrafim nosim lahem gam ke ma'achalam b'chayayim. So the cat also needs something to eat. So Hashem allows the cat to eat the mouse. But when is that? Behigia kitzam lamus. In other words, when the cates of this mouse arrives, this mouse was supposed to live for 186 days. So on day 186, Hashem allows the cat to eat the mouse, which is quite fascinating. So the Radak over here, actually, if you take a look, he presents three perspectives on this question. We're running late, so we're not going to read it inside, but take a look. He says that some say that when a limb is killed by a lion, that must have been some sort of punishment. A lamb, not a limb. In other words, the lamb must have done something wrong. That's view number one. View number two is no, only humans are rewarded and punished for their behavior. So clearly, if the lamb is mauled by the lion, it didn't do anything wrong. And number three, he says, is that we believe, this is his perspective, Radak's correct perspective, that animals are rewarded and punished for their involvement with human beings. And he brings support for this view from a number of psukim in Chumash, like we said, "Ba'achas damchem lenafsho seichem ed rosh, miyad kochaya ed rishenu." So that pasuk sounds like, I'm going to punish the beast for what it does to a human. Likewise, the Mishnah Bracho says that, why is there a mitzvah of pidyon peter chamor? Because the donkeys assisted the Jewish people by taking out their booty from Mitzrayim. Radak actually says there's a fourth view, but it's not even worth writing. Okay. Another place where we see hashgacha on animals in Chazal is a fascinating Yerushalmi. It's also quoted by the Tosfos in Avodah Zarah, Tes Zayin Amud Beis. You have it over here. Yerushalmi says that when Shmuel Yochai left the cave after 13 years, he saw a bird approaching a bird trap. And there was a bas kol from Shemayim that says, you know, this bird is going to be trapped or this bird isn't. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai said, oh, if a bird's fate is in God's hands, so certainly a human's fate is in God's hands. And this inspired Rav Shimon bar Yochai to leave the cave. Now, the story in itself isn't conclusive because maybe it just doesn't say there's hashkacha, just saying that this is what's going to happen. But at the same time, the fact that Rav Shimon bar Yochai learned a lesson from here, it sounds like it's hashkacha. And this point is made, you have it over here, by Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz. He says that Rav Shimon's initial understanding, this is over here, you have Yaros Dvash, Chelek Beis Drashvad. He says, what did Rav Shimon bar Yochai originally think, and what did he learn? So when he first left the cave, he learned like the Rambam. There's no hashgacha on animals. But when he heard the bas kol saying that there is hashgacha on animals, so he learned that about the extent of hashgacha and decided, im kenim dvar melo, I should leave the cave as well. So that these are some makoros that we find in Chazal and Rishonim about hashgacha on animals. I think there's a very fundamental chakira that we could ask on this shaila. Again, we saw the Baal Shem Tov says it, we saw it in Rishonim, in Chazal, and a very fundamental question. And the question is, like we could call this, what I have over here, the minimalist reading and the maximalist reading. What's the difference? Is the pshat that the hashgacha that takes place for animals is alts the animal, or is it alts humans? That's our shaila. Is it alts the animals or is it alts humans? So it could be, and this is what it sounds like, I think, from the Radak, that it's only alts humans. In other words, there's no fundamental hashgacha for animals alts the animals. But insofar as they relate to humans, there is. Let's give a mashal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, Daisy, the cow, goes ahead and it eats some spoiled grass and it has a stomach ache. So why'd that happen? Not because of anything that relates to Daisy. Daisy didn't do any averos. But because Yaakov, who owns Daisy, needs some type of tsaris in his life. And so now he has to deal with this sick cow, Daisy. But it's only for the sake of humans. Take a look over here. We have from Rav Moshe Cordovero, who makes this point. He's medayke from the Gemara in the Darim, Daf Memal, from Medala, Shmuel Chazye, Lahu, Huisa, Yasiva, Al Akrusa, Akruksa. So he saw a certain frog, and the scorpion was sitting on the frog. The Avra Nahara, as the frog crossed the river, got a lift. Tarka Gavra Umayas. And then it stung a guy on the other side of the river to leave. In other words, there is this hashkacha on the frog and on the scorpion, but it's all for the people. Oh. And that's what Shmuel learns from that, that everybody gets what they're supposed to get. If you take a look, even among Hasidic thinkers, we see this idea. You have a piece here from Reb Chaim Sanzer, who says that, again, it's only for the sake of humans. He says that even though the Baal Shem Tov said that if a leaf falls from a tree, there's hashkacha, but it's not for the sake of the leaf, it's for the sake of the person. Now, you might ask over here, and this brings us back to that point that we saw from Lubavitch Rebbe, like, one second, how could it be that how a leaf falls makes a difference for a person, right? That seems very strange. Very strange. Why should a leaf falling have any effect on me? So I think what he's saying is a very interesting idea. Again, maybe this is what Lubavitch Rebbe meant earlier, which is, you know, it's an idea nowadays that's known as the butterfly effect. The idea that even the smallest things that happen in nature, so they actually have an effect on people or on everything else. You know, how a butterfly flaps its wings in Indonesia, you know, might even have an effect on the weather patterns in New Jersey. I'm not a scientist. I don't know so much about that idea, but that's basically, it seems to me, what Reb Chaim Sanzer is saying. Oh, so if you take this approach, then the Besht's view isn't so different from the Rishonim. But then among some thinkers, they actually go much further. You see this over here in the what I have called under the sources, the revolutionary reading. And they hold, no, that there's hashkacha for everything, for everything. Maybe that's exactly the lesson Reb Shimon Bar Yochai learned when he learned, left the cave. And this is how they explain that famous story with the Baal Shem Tov. There are various versions of the story, but the basic idea is that one day the Baal Shem Tov was walking with his students, and there was a wind, and it blew off a leaf, and he told his students, you know, my children, you should know that the wind came when it did, because the sun was beating down on this worm that was sitting on the edge of the leaf, and she was crying to Hashem, and Hashem sent the wind to knock over the leaf to give her some shade. And that seems to be taking the approach that, it, you know, it's even for the animals. Okay, so much more to say, but we're out of time. So B'siyata Dishmaya, not sure yet what sugya we're going to do next. Zev wanted to do Bashert. That brings us back to Hashkacha. They say we'd go on. All right, we'll figure it out. Be'ez Hashem, we'll be moving on, and everyone should have a good Shabbos, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks. I think the whole idea of animals davening is a fascinating idea. You know?
Yes. The question is, what does that mean? In other words, the Pashup shot in, you know, you look at Parak Shira, and it talks about, you know, what each animal says. So the Pashtus is, it doesn't mean that the animal are saying things. Animals don't have intelligence. They don't have Bechira. It means that the Mahus of their Bria reflects a certain idea. You know, when frogs are Mekarkarin, so that reflects a certain thing. And you see that, you know, when you learn about the Makas Tzardeya. But again, you know, could be that certain, as I said, the revolutionary reading aren't learning that way. You know, I don't know how literal to take those sources, but it's very hard to imagine that it's literally true that there was a worm that was crying out to Hashem and Hashem sent a leaf to save it.
Unless it was a Gilgal.
Yeah, so that's correct. If we go back to that approach, so maybe that's the idea. Again, but, very hard for me to relate to that concept.
When I was in Neri Yisrael, they told us a story that Rav Rudiman was giving Shir, and there was like this cat that started showing up. It would show up when Shir started and leave when Shir finished, and for a while. And when this first started happening, someone wanted to shoo the cat away, and Rav Rudiman said, "Don't, it's a Gilgal from someone." Something like that.
Okay. Fascinating. Rav Rudiman, even though he became more Litvish as he, you know, after he, you know, went to Slobodka and the like, but he came from Hasidic Shastak.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, no, Rav Rudiman, the Neri Yisrael, they try to keep it quiet. But but Rav Rudiman came from a Hasidic family, and not only that, it's a Lubavitcher family, I think. Wow. And his father... you know, they wanted him to go to Tomchei Tamimim, the Lubavitcher Yeshiva, I think, and his father said, no, he should go to the best yeshiva, that so his learning will be the best. First he went to one place, and he ended up in Slobodka, but Lemaisa, Rav Rudiman, comes from Hasidic stock. So
that's really cool.
As I said, Lemaisa, even non-Hasidim, you know, the idea of Gilgal and Shamus is quite widespread. As I said, even the Mishnah Berurah refers to it.
Anyways, thank you so much and have a wonderful Shabbos.
Okay, good Shabbos.
Oh, thank you very much, Rebbe.
Good Shabbos, good Shabbos.
Thank you. Can I ask a quick question about...
Sure.
So it was actually regarding Rav Wieder's shir last night. I don't know. Maybe if it's the type of thing where, like, on the recording, I don't know, I'll see what Rebbe thinks. I was wondering how mainstream, like, the idea that that Rav Wieder was talking about last night was in terms of, like, does everyone agree to that? That Medinat Yisrael, like, it seemed to be like a davar pashut, like in the thought of Rav Kook. But
oh, I mean, that was his point. He said Rav Kook was, you know, many Gedolei Yisrael disagreed with that approach. He was presenting Rav Kook's approach last night, and that's his approach. But I don't think. But you're right. It's not the. Was not agreed upon. Rav Kook, even as most Gedolim acknowledged the godless of Rav Kook, but they still thought that he was incorrect in sort of the way he viewed the world. And again, now is not the time to go into it, you know, what exactly their Nekudas HaMachlokas was. But I think the purpose of last night's shiur was to present Rav Kook's view, and that's the view that that he thinks is correct, but not necessarily he wasn't. But it's true; it's a chiddush. Not everybody agreed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. Shkayach. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too, Rebbe.